I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a conversion therapy camp here in 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
And with us today is Lola Kelly. Lola.
Amazing. It's
actress,
an amazing shirt.
Director, producer, writer.
Yeah. Multi-hyphenate.
Former guest came on to do Angela's Ashes.
This is a little different than Angela's Ashes.
Yeah, I was gonna say, obviously she has a bit of a lane she likes to stay in.
Man, is that not true? We'll talk about that later.
Today we're doing But I'm a Cheerleader, which is an amazing movie. Interestingly enough, it is a little cuspy for us in terms of 99. This movie... released in America until, I believe, 2000, but it was released in film.
July of 2000,
Per the rules of this podcast, if it's an American film, it is when its world premiere happened, and that was in 1999, so it made it. So, Lola, welcome back to the podcast. Thank you for coming.
Thank you
for being so enthusiastic about this movie. What's going on with you? How's your pandemic?
My pandemic is pretty okay, you know. I'm alive and healthy, which is all I can ask for. My relatives are alive and healthy, but it's crazy. This is a weird time in history.
To say the least, it is a strange time.
I want to start watching lots of movies. So
it's interesting because I want to start a new feature on the podcast without asking you, Phil. And my new feature that I'd like to start is with our guests. What have you watched during quarantine that you really love? That you've never seen before? TV, movies, music videos?
This is so... I'm not making this up, but I think I've seen Portrait of a Lady on Fire maybe 15 times.
Appropriate. Queer
appropriate.
Cinema.
Very all appropriate. Right.
It's just so perfect. And it's also about isolation, you know, and it makes isolation so sexy.
And masks too. They wear masks a lot of that.
Yeah. I just can't stop watching it. It just fills me with all of the good feelings. I saw a few, and I keep also, I've been deep diving into queer cinema, and because I'm writing a queer film, and I keep coming back to Portrait of a Lady on Fire as like a palate cleanser, because there's just like, there's so many that just don't nail the landing. So I won't talk trash on the films that I've seen that have required so many viewings of Portrait of a Lady on Fire. But
yeah. To that point, I think it's interesting how this film was received back in 99 and 2000, and how by critics, maybe more specifically than audiences, but like they didn't really know what to make of this at the time. Like, I think that it just sort of, which is again why I think it's so groundbreaking and so great. But you saw this in 99, correct? Like you saw this around the time that it came out, correct?
Don't know if I saw it in 99 or 2000, but I saw it right. I might have seen it at a festival. My mom was a cinema professor. So I had weird access to indie movies and all sorts of stuff. So I might have seen it. I remember who I saw it with. I saw it with two of my friends. And I saw it in like the West Side Pavilion, like indie movie theater. And I have such a distinct memory of like being in that theater with these teenagers who immediately, like within the opening sequence, just like laughed out loud and pointed at me when they talk about like her being a vegetarian and having like flowers on her pillows that are very vaginal, and like her bedroom was just like my bedroom, and like the two people I was with just like completely just like pointed at me and laughed out loud.
I think that at the time it felt like, and I unfortunately would clump myself in with this as well. I didn't see this in 99, and I think a lot of people dismissed this film or clumped it in with your John Waters or your Greg Araki, you know, or various filmmakers like that, that felt, I don't know, very sort of theatrical, very kind of heightened. And I think that some people, myself included at the time, didn't really know what to do with that. Now I look at this film and I mean, I think it's brilliant. I think it's incredibly well done, but, it's a very in your face movie.
Yeah. Certainly.
And some people don't love that, I guess, just, but you know,
yeah. Jamie Babbitt talked about that. I remember even like back then about the sort of reclaiming of camp for female filmmakers. And I think that John Waters is, I mean, he was my favorite. So going into that movie, I already was like, oh, I'm on board. As soon as the opening, like that scene where like everybody's in brown and like she's in pink, and it's just like all of that really on the nose, bright camp stuff felt kind of John Waters, but like, there's a cynicism to John Waters movies, which I love, but like there's such a femme quality to this that's also kind of lovely and romantic that I had never seen before. And I think that it was something that like a very small demographic was like craving. I was in that demo, but nobody, at least that I know of, no one had seen that pairing of just like aggressive camp and just a rom-com that's kind of like lovely. And I think that it made it strange categorically to a lot of critics.
Totally. But
to its, you know, to its great credit, the only thing that this movie takes seriously is the love story between the two central characters. The movie slows down when you're with them. The score changes. The way it's shot has changed. You have a lot of close-ups and inserts on lips and faces and hands and thighs and things like that. It's a lot of soft focus shots shot at night. It really does, I don't know, as the, you know, pretty straight guy, not the straightest.
Are you bisexual too?
I'm not bisexual. I just love camp. But as a pretty straight guy, it really did feel like I had the most cursory understanding of what the lesbian experience is for a teenager who's just finding herself. Because on one hand, it's this kind of not necessarily lesbian, it's really more queer experience. It's this almost cornucopia of different ideas and worlds that come together, all these things that are marginalized, not accepted by society, but also something very sweet, pure, and real in the middle that you can't get anywhere else, certainly not from, you know, that dopey boyfriend back home. So I thought it was, yeah, really,
he's
really
so gross.
Love it.
He's so gross. He's the kissing is so gross.
He does I think Jamie Babbitt did an amazing job of directing that like heterosexual makeout scene to be like the most disgusting
in the car.
It's so gross. And even like when he sees her at her locker and he starts like sticking his tongue down her throat just in the hallways too.
Yeah.
There's two J.B. Babbitt quotes that I want to read really quickly that piggyback on what you were saying, Lola, about. She said, if I were writing a paper about it, I'd say it's feminization of the camp aesthetic, bringing emotion to something that is hyper-realized. She also said that some people say that I'm trying to be John Waters, but the film doesn't have that bite, and I don't want it to have that bite. John Waters hates romantic comedies. He thinks they're cheesy. But there's a certain part of me that is cheesy. I'm a small-town girl when it comes to relationships, and I wanted to tell a conventionally romantic story. And I think that to both your points, the romance between Megan and oh my God, why am
Graham.
I forgetting? Graham, sorry, of course, is just really beautiful. Like, not to say just, but it is so beautiful. And it's so pure and it's so overtly romantic that it, you know, it kind of bucks everything around it. Because everything around it is kind of, you know, very heightened, very surreal. And then at the heart of this thing is this just giant beating heart of these two people that are so adorable together and romantic together. It's yeah, it really made the whole thing really come to life for me.
I think there's moments where it takes self-acceptance seriously, like with Dante Pasco's character, once they run into each other again. And I think those are kind of lovely. But for the most part, yeah, it lampoons everything, including queer culture, which was something I really liked that it satirized as well. Like, I think Jamie Babbitt's response to you sort of saying that you're kind of straight because you like camp would be like, you get to be straight and also like camp. Like, that's okay. And like, that's kind of what she's challenging with this film, is this notion also about gender roles, like Jan's character, obviously, like that you can be like a softball playing mask person who's a woman who's straight. And like, there were so many lines in queer culture in the late 90s that I think she challenges, as well as, like, obviously she's primarily like completely lampooning heteronormative culture and how toxic it is. But like, yeah, I think that there's just, she is just making fun of so much, so concisely. And then at the center of it is this beautiful, sincere love story.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I obviously had a very similar takeaway. I was really just taken with how it doesn't believe in labels. You know, this idea that like you are one thing, even just like later in the film when Megan is talking to, forgive me, the two male characters when she's living with those guys, and she's talking about, you know, how do I become a stereotypical lesbian? And they're like, why do you need to become that? Like, you can become your version of a lesbian. Like, it's really wonderful that the film just doesn't believe in any sort of getting rid of any rigidity when it comes to the way that you perceive yourself, the way you perceive others, that everyone is who they are, and that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that moment I sobbed. Like, that movie, the first time I saw that movie, I was just completely like in tears, either laughing or just like seeing myself on screen or feeling something like acceptance on screen for the first time in my life. And it was just such a, like, I found it so funny, but then it would have moments like that where I was, and just to clarify, I'm bisexual, and like, I'm also 5'2" and like tiny, like, and femme, like I appear femme. So I think like, for me, I was always like sort of put in this box of like, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't gay enough to like, anytime I would like try to put my toe in that water, I was just sort of like, what are you doing here? Like, so seeing that, especially that speech that that lovely couple gives to her, where, you know, it's just, where she gets to be herself. And that's so radical. That's so lovely.
It's really interesting because, you know, as we do this podcast, there are certain films that I feel are obvious touchstones, if you will, certain movies that I'm sure Candy feels, you know, where it's like, these are the movies that people love, or these are the movies that people have an affinity for. And this is a film that a lot of people have talked to me about and have said how important it was to them and how much of a sort of a movie that made them feel comfortable to come out or made them feel like it's interesting because it's not necessarily a film that I would have made that association with. And it, obviously as a straight person, perhaps that's why, but also because at the time, this really wasn't a particularly big movie. It had a lot of I don't want to say a cult following, but it had a lot of video following. It really grew in its esteem over the years. But I feel like in its release, it didn't have sort of the lightning rod that it seems to have now. You know, I was reading this interview with Natasha Lyonne, and she was talking about, there's this quote here where she said, "I remember these girls coming up to us after the screening at Sundance. They were crying. They were saying they'd never seen a movie like this, and it was completely life-changing experience for them. And 20 years later, Clea and I continue to have the privilege of that very humbling experience on people, that this was something that was something that stuck in my mind, that it was actually helping people, making them feel less alone in this world, which is a huge thing for a film to do." And It's a really powerful thing, and I think part of it has to do with the fact that, and perhaps this I'm painting with too broad a brush, but it feels like comedies don't always have the same power. People have this association that the dramas are the things that help people through this stuff, and comedies maybe not as much. I don't know if you see it the same way, but I think it's just this unfortunate thing that like comedies aren't quote unquote as important as dramas. And I think that this movie being so open and so sort of full hearted, I think makes it a more important movie than a lot of dramas.
Yeah. I wish that comedies didn't get, I feel like you've heard this rant of mine, Phil, where I'm such a proponent of comedy, and I think it is a much harder genre to nail. And I think it is so vital. I think that.
That's why I went to drama.
It's so easy to make drama. It's like a cakewalk. But like the lubricant of comedy, I feel like the Trojan horse of like letting people in with a laugh or something familiar. I think horror does the same thing of just like, here is this thing that's pop, that's like comfortable to you, and like I'm going to draw you in with that and like then radicalize you. I think this movie did that so, so well. And I think that a lot of my, at least at the time, granted I was in a sort of like bubble, I was living in Los Angeles, so I think I maybe didn't have the experience that like everybody had, but a lot of my straight friends, who saw it, well, it's complicated because some of them ended up kind of coming out as queer after seeing this movie. But some of the really like just straight people who saw this, like were able to really engage and like learn a lot by seeing this and laughing and being drawn in by the comedy of it.
Some thoughts.
Yeah.
Love to throw them out. So what I'm trying to kind of get my head around what we're talking about is it's kind of interesting that the metatextual reading of this movie also it can be applied to this movie, right? This idea that you don't have to be one thing, I think, is why people had a hard time with this movie. And I think this might be what we're kind of bumping up against in this conversation. I don't really think this movie is best classified as a comedy. That doesn't feel right to me. And I don't really think it's best qualified as anything except maybe queer cinema.
I think it's a rom-com.
Well, it could be whatever you want it to be, right? Like if you need to put it in a box. But I think that's the point I'm making is you don't need to put it in a box, right? Mm. You don't need – I think that's the point of the movie, that things don't have to fit in a box. And I think that's what we're working with here. Now, when I'm kind of – it's not that I'm grappling with it. I'm kind of recognizing the power of the movie in the moment, in that when you look at queer cinema, and queer is such a catch-all term. It encompasses basically everything outside of the mainstream in terms of gender and sexual identity, but beyond even that, right? So you have trans cinema, and we actually are going to be talking about a movie with a prominent trans character later. And you have gay cinema, and you have lesbian cinema, and you have bisexual cinema, and you have things that encompass all of these things together. And then you have kind of high camp, which isn't even necessarily about gay characters. Like, we watched Drop Dead Gorgeous and Jawbreaker, both of which are like very gay friendly movies that aren't about gay people, right? That are lauded and loved. You have gay icons that weren't playing gay characters. You have, you know, Judy Garland's and the Liza Minnelli's of the world that aren't necessarily playing gay characters. They're just gay friendly. Sorry about my dog. So in the there's just something about this that I'm getting at, which is basically so much of queer cinema, I think, lives on the periphery of queer life, if that makes sense, right? It's not getting directly at what it's like to be a young person coming out and have it not be a dark, and I don't think Love, Simon is a dark movie, but Love, Simon is a very serious movie when it comes down to it. So not having a, you know, a very serious coming out story. This is a very unusual movie. And what I said in the beginning, that this really makes me feel like I have at least an entree into a better understanding of the experience of a young, in this instance, a young lesbian. It's because this feels like it was made from a place of lived experience more than almost any movie I can think of. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I totally hear you, and I really agree with the idea that this movie doesn't fit in a box, that doesn't have a sort of a quote-unquote overt label. I mean, I think it is funny.
But I want to say one more thing.
Yeah, of course.
Just to back up what Lola was saying, like, part of the reason why it doesn't fit in a box is because it does feel like a romantic comedy, but it's a queer romantic comedy, right? And there is no real reason why romantic comedies can't be between two characters of the same sex, of course. But that also does feel kind of radical in its own way. It's almost more radical to take something that, if it were about a heterosexual couple, would be kind of middle of the road, you know, and then do something like John Waters does.
I don't think it's middle of the road. I think that there's like the ending. Mm-hmm. And the lack of, I think the ending is radical, whether it's heterosexual or queer. And the relationship and the nature of it and how pure it is and how like truly like relationship goals it is. Mm-hmm. I had not seen that in any rom-com. Mm-hmm. Like, I know we're sort of like jumping to the end, and
we'll cover everything.
But yeah, I mean, like that last scene where she retains her love of cheer and uses it to like get her girl back. And neither of them compromise their true self. Like in so many rom-coms, there's this like makeover narrative of like, basically like make yourself pretty so that the boy likes you, or like give up a part of yourself. Like don't be a dork, like don't be a nerd, but she's just like a cheerleader. But the way that she changes is by like loving herself and accepting herself and inviting someone to love her. And then that love is reciprocated, and she loves like she truly loves that person the way that she is, and loves that she's a cheerleader. She doesn't change at the end. And like, I think that that is actually something that hasn't been explored much.
I totally agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's funny as you were talking there, I was just looking at just even the title, like "But I'm a Cheerleader" is in and of itself deconstructing the notion of what it means to be a cheerleader. Like that idea that you can't be a cheerleader and be gay, or that she can't be who she wants to be, is completely obviously blown up by the end of the movie. Like that is sort of a perfect encapsulation, I think, of Kenny's point and your point of that this movie is all about getting rid of labels, that it's about deconstructing your notions of what it means to be any of these things, which is, I don't know, I think it's just really, really exciting. And watching it, I really did find myself, first of all, I found myself thinking, like, why the hell didn't I watch this in 1999? But also, I mean, truthfully, just being like, why didn't I see this movie? Like, what was it that kept me away from this film? I mean, clearly I saw most of these movies, so I can't really tell you why. But also just really hit with...
I didn't know what it was. Honestly, I didn't even know what it was until we started this podcast. I had heard of it, and I didn't know one thing about it. Until we started looking into the movies in 99.
This was a movie podcast. That... There were, so I worked at, as our listeners know, I worked at a handful of video stores in Toronto, and one of the ones that I worked at when I was younger had a girl who worked there who was gay or bi, and this was a movie she constantly put on in the video store. Like, it was always
classic.
On.
Classic. Yes.
Right? Like, it was always on.
Yeah.
And I just always, and the thing is, like, I never sat down to watch it, but, like, you know how video stores were back in the day? It had all these TV screens.
Yeah.
And it's such a visually arresting movie.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's just, it's so in your face.
The production design is amazing.
Like, it really is. And I just remember always having it on. And this girl really loving it. But that was really my only association with the movie until I sat down to watch it the other day. And I love that, you know, it's on the Criterion Channel right now until the end of July. But you know, and Clea and Natasha did a whole interview on their website, which we'll link to on our Twitter. But it's such an exciting, fresh, such a specific movie. And I don't know, really loved it.
Yeah, I had such a visceral reaction to it when I saw it. And it was my favorite movie of the year, obviously hugely personal for me. But it became that movie that I would like obsessively play for people as a litmus test, like, especially girls. Like, if I wasn't sure like where they fell, I'd be like, "Hey, you want to come watch a movie?" And like, I would just put on "But I'm a Cheerleader" and just like watch their reactions. But I think that there's so many. It is like it's definitively like a cult classic for queer people, but especially I think female queer people. And I've heard like that bisexual girl who worked at your video store, I've heard like so many stories about women just obsessively playing that movie, and almost like we're just like Bible thumpers but I'm cheerleader. Like, have you heard the good word of Jamie Babbitt?
I want to use that awkward segue to talk about a couple of other things.
Okay.
One is the absence of religion.
Mm-hmm. Which yeah, I did find that interesting.
Interesting. I think that's also more radical than I think it may seem. I think the intended audience of this movie probably had no love for modern Christianity, and it would have been a little boring to turn your Bible thumping, you know, Southerners into the villains.
Well, I would like to actually say that it would be scary. Like, I think that it was a choice to, I can't speak for Jamie Babbitt, but I do think that like for most queer people, religion is terrifying because it is the source of so much pain. Mm-hmm. So I think it's hard to retain the comedy if you really bring the monster into the movie and explicitly do so. Obviously, like, Adam and Eve are in it, and there's all sorts of references to, yeah. And there's the place itself feels just so seeped in this sort of Christian heteronormative culture, but they don't explicitly talk about religion. I also think that it's more inclusive in that way. Like, my friend who was queer and Jewish, like, loved that it wasn't explicit because he felt like it made it more inclusive and it wasn't just this like Christian dogma explicitly. So it sort of allowed him to paint whatever he wanted to paint onto that somewhat blank, murky canvas.
Yeah.
There is a little bit of religion in the Jewish character, but it's pretty,
Joel,
but not I know what you're saying, like, though, Kenny.
Yeah. You know, when you think of conversion therapy, you think of Mike Pence.
The kind of stuff Mike Pence wants to
send everybody to. Those are explicitly Christian camps, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to make this not, I think I hear what you're saying, Lola. I also think it's a really strong creative choice. And I'm not saying you're not, but I think it's a really strong creative choice and a really radical choice, because what it's doing now, it was a little triggering for me in a way, because I've spent a good deal of time in group therapy. And I find group therapy to be something that, when done right, with willing participants, you know, who are open, to be something that's extremely helpful. And what I took from this movie wasn't that they thought group therapy wasn't helpful. It was how easy it is for people in charge to ascribe mental illness to a group of people and use, in my opinion, legitimate therapeutic methods to make them feel like they have to change something that you don't actually have to change. It's very creepy, and I think it's a little bit of a call to the psychiatric community to be extremely responsible when dealing with patients,
and to not use these
therapies on people who don't actually need help from these therapies. So it was, the reason I say it was triggering was because I hope people don't walk away from this movie thinking legitimate therapeutic methods are being demonized. I don't think that's what was happening. I think it's, you know, it's people using good methods for bad reasons, which is very scary to me.
Yeah. Jamie Babbitt's mother actually ran a treatment program for drugs and alcohol for teens. Mm-hmm. And so she talks about mining that a lot. And I actually worked in those. I worked in sober livings and rehabs for years. I'm sober myself. And so it is, it's such a murky, like, I totally understand where she was. I didn't in 99, but having watched it, like, that was something in the reviewing of it recently where I was like, she really nails just how, like, how troubling trying to help people who are not voluntarily there, and how that can just be so rife. And I hear what you're saying, and, you know, it, with drug and alcohol stuff, it's obviously like you're trying to save kids from killing themselves from drugs and alcohol. So it's, there's such good intentions, but even in that world, there's so many people who can take advantage. There's so many horror stories but then, you know, conversion therapy is even worse. And there's just, I mean,
it's really most
evil thing.
I totally hear you, Kenny. The weaponization of group therapy by quite frankly nefarious groups is incredibly scary.
But the word nefarious, no offense, the word nefarious to me is a little misplaced. I don't.
I'm speaking of conversion therapy. I'm speaking of
no.
Of
so
that.
Am I. So yeah. Am I. So am I. It's more nuanced than that, right? Like people who run conversion therapy groups, and I think this was really well done in this movie, aren't like evil people trying to sterilize people because they don't want them to give birth or something like that. They think that what they're doing is the moral good. So
sure, they think they're doing God's will. Yeah.
That matters, though. That matters. Yeah, like it matters that they're. It matters that bad people are using good techniques.
100%.
And it matters. Like that's what's like truly scary, because then you get to a place where people start saying, hypothetically, where people start saying group therapy is bad because they use it in conversion houses. Mm-hmm. That is dangerous. But like it's so much more nuanced and interesting than that, because like any kind of forced therapy is dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, any kind, and that was the second point I wanted to make about the movie, which I think is really interesting about it, but I've always been a little, and Lola, you're definitely, you know, the person to answer this. I've always been a little uncomfortable with the idea of, you know, as a person who loves Broadway and Bob Fosse and Disney and all these things that have been, you know, kind of labeled femme or labeled gay by our society. I've always been a little uncomfortable with people using the markers of homosexuality as a way to say you are gay and then have the movie substantiate that. Now, the movie I always thought of that was a little irresponsible in that respect was In-N-Out. It always made me a little uncomfortable that because this guy liked Judy Garland, everyone in town thought he was gay, and he was gay. Like that seems a little too simple to me. It made me a little. And again, Lola, I really want your take, because maybe I'm totally off base, but all the markers of lesbianism that her family saw, that she was a Melissa Etheridge fan, and that she liked George O'Keefe, and that she was a vegetarian and wasn't a great kisser, don't feel like those are, you know, that makes up a case.
And I think Jamie Babbitt is arguing that. Like, I think that there's a reason why all of the straight people are the ones who are saying that, like, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, like you like these things.
But they were right.
And therefore, right. They weren't right that those things. Well, okay. So it's very, that stuff is very murky. And I think she takes it on really well. But I think that there's a way in which, at least I can only speak for myself, but like queer signifiers or like things that signify your sexuality to the world become something that a lot of queer people will adopt. Sometimes when you don't even like it, just so that you can be part of this culture and feel a part of and like, you know, feel at home in your skin and feel like, and just also like in the 90s, at least, like for, I'll talk about myself. Like in the 90s, there was no dating apps for gay people. Like there was kind of like no way to tell the world that you were gay in a safe way, other than just like walking up to people and hitting on them. And obviously that's super dangerous. Sure. So like, I love that Jamie Babbitt like has that room where it's like, you go to that house and it's like full of rainbows and like everything is fucking rainbows. And like, just like, he's wearing like a rainbow, like pajama set. And like, everything is just like, hi, I'm gay. And like, there's something like so like funny, but also touching about it, because like, I still see that with like young people who come out, but like it, especially in the 90s, like there was just this thing of like needing to signify to people like what you were so that you could find love, like so that you could find your people, like not even love, but just like find your community. Like queer culture is, like you mentioned, like so amorphous that it includes stuff like Judy Garland. And I think like as we've progressed and like these were more open about talking about sexuality, and we're more open about it not being so boxed, that's becoming less and less of a thing. But I will say that, like, it was kind of crazy to see this and think about my experience as like a queer person in the 90s versus like 2020, and like people who are the same age coming out now and what their experience can be versus then. My coming out story was so murky. Like, I came out and thought I was a lesbian, actually, after seeing this movie. Legitimately, I was like, I'm a lesbian. Wow. And I questioned like every attraction I'd ever had to men because of like all of these like sort of cultural touchstones, mm-hmm. and qualities about myself that I liked, and like all of this stuff. And then my experience of like coming out into a very male dominated West Hollywood in the 90s, it was a very specific culture. So I'm not like criticizing the culture at large, but like I was going to like the Abbey as like in like, you know, early 2000s. And I feel like that was like that very specific part of the world was like sort of run by like the Regina Georges of like the male population. And like, you did have to, like, there was a sort of like rules and regulations, mm-hmm. like, and I was just, I didn't fit into those boxes. And like, I wasn't at all butch, and I didn't have the qualifications. I didn't have my papers in order. And it was just such a strange time of just like a lot of pride and a lot of positivity. But then even within the queer community, there was a lot of sort of biases and rules that I think Jamie Babbitt totally went for, mm-hmm. and satirized with so much love. And challenged with so much love. Yeah. And I think with Jan is the, like the best example of that.
Sure, sure, sure.
She's straight. She's like, I'm straight. And like, you don't get to tell me I'm gay.
Yeah.
And I think we see that. And I think that I love her for that. I love her for saying that if you like Judy Garland, that doesn't mean you're gay.
The rules and regulations thing is really interesting to me. Because I think I know why they exist, or why they existed and why they still exist to some extent.
Totally.
Safety. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Like it's when you're a persecuted minority, they kind of had no choice but to keep the circle pretty tight and make sure everyone that entered into it was a safe person. Right. You see this very much so now in trans culture. Right. Which I think is, you know, they're wildly persecuted right now. And I think a lot of trans people are very scared, and they're very, you know, protective of their community, and, you know, with great reason. But yeah, I think in the early 2000s, I think that's why those rules existed. And that must have been pretty hard. That must have been pretty hard to feel like you may have found your spot. And yet the, you know, years of a patriarchal society that didn't have room for people that didn't fit the heteronormative ideal was kind of closed off. That must have been weird.
Yeah. And like you said, I think that there was a reason for that. And I think it was protection. And I think like I spent a lot of my life not feeling like queer enough to even really like claim that. And I think like, there was a part of me that was just like, oh, you know, I don't want to claim that identity because it takes away from other people. Sure. And I think that that's toxic and leads to erasure. Now I understand that like that's not correct. And bisexuals are absolutely part of the queer community. But I also get where some of that protective layer came from in the queer community because of exactly what you're talking about. And there's resources that are available to queer people that are limited. And I think like you want to make sure that people aren't taking advantage of that grace and goodwill and all of that stuff. I really do get it. I do feel like it's very interesting to in this era of this civil rights explosion that we're seeing now. It's also interesting to look back on that era and think about how many white men, like in that niche that I was talking about. And I know some of these guys now. I don't know all of them, but I can understand how, and I say this without judgment. Like I say this with a lot of like empathy, because like being a white guy and like, you know, we're in, they say like white supremacy isn't a shark, it's the water and we're all in it. Like, I think that these guys were kids, you know, like when I knew them, they were children and they grew up, they were born with the entitlement of a white dude, but were on the outside. And then they finally like enter into a community where they are allowed to be themselves. And like all of that sort of supremacy, I think, did show up. And it didn't affect me as much as, like, I think that I have to also realize that I have a privilege, obviously, as a white person. Like, I think that there was a fair amount of alienation of people of color and BIPOC people and trans people in that community. But it's grown and changed so much. Mm-hmm. And it's so diverse and vibrant and beautiful now. And I think that's a testament to that culture and how it has fought for inclusivity. And but there's still shades of it, you know. Like there was a pride parade this year that was turned into a BLM protest, and it was bad, because the white organizers were like, we're gonna do this as a protest for BLM, which is so well intentioned, but then with their statements and everything, we're just like, great, we've worked with the great police officers of West Hollywood. And like this whole statement was just so tone deaf. And like, it became so, so clear so quickly that there's so much white run queer organizations that don't allow in Black people. And, that still is a problem even within the queer community, now in 2020. Yeah,
it's almost a good thing that happened, because it almost takes those kind of like big public screw ups to get people to realize that they're part of the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and to your point, very well intentioned people,
right?
But you know, that's the whole road to hell is paved with good intentions. That's a real thing, to me, and I think we've all kind of experience that to some extent, that good intentions aren't enough, and that even over the course of this podcast, I can't speak to the queer experience. All I can do is tell you what I have observed from the outside, and I have, you know, plenty of queer people in my life who I've spoken to and I care about deeply, and I think I have some level of understanding. But like, for instance, I am, let's put it this way. I'm not less likely to write queer characters, but I am less likely to write queer characters without first doing a lot of research into that stuff. And the same thing goes with BIPOC characters, and the same thing, you know, goes with almost any character that doesn't represent me, or isn't representative of me. And I think that's a very important thing moving forward as well. You know, I do think that there was this idea before in our community, the writing community, that you can write anything, you can do whatever you want, and you just can't. You know, you just can't sit down at your computer and write a, you know, Black trans character and think you know what you're talking about.
So. It's interesting. I fully agree with you. And what's interesting is that pisses off a lot of people. Do you know what I mean? That there's a lot of writers that really relish that idea of being able to write anything that they want, because
you still
just do your fucking research. Just be. Well, I agree. But I would also, I just, it's interesting how, some people take umbrage with that, I guess is what I'm getting at.
There was a movie this year called Waves that was about a black family that was written and directed by a white guy that, as far as I know, at least speaking to black friends, did an incredible job of depicting an American middle-class black family. It's possible, you know, it's possible. Just
very
fucking hard.
I saw recently I watched The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which was also written and directed by a white filmmaker. And I'm not, it's certainly possible. I think that, but to your point, you got to do the work. You know what I mean? And I think you have to show the respect that's necessary to whatever the demographic is that you're speaking of, if you're not a part of it yourself and, or at least, you know.
And yeah, we also have to pay BIPOC people for that work. The ideal is obviously like we hire more BIPOC writers and directors.
I certainly wasn't suggesting otherwise.
No, sure. But that, the other thing I was going to say right after that was, yes, you hire people, of course. You also donate. Like, you can't play in other people's playgrounds and
not give them what they deserve.
Well, you can't profit off of other people's cultures without donating to those cultures as well. You have
100%
substantial donations.
It's interesting what you guys are bringing up. I'm having trouble like even processing enough to respond fully to it. But I like The Favorite definitely came up in my mind, just as I can't speak to the BIPOC experience, but I can speak as a queer woman. And The Favorite was an interesting one for me because like I had just seen a queer representation, like a female queer director, and I really don't want to name it because I don't like to,
shit on.
But it like left me like so cold, and it was primarily because they cast a very straight actress who was just like so straight and there was just no chemistry in this queer film, and I was just so like deflated by it because it's so exciting when you get to see a queer film. So I had just seen that, and then I saw The Favorite like shortly thereafter, and I thought that it was so like I saw so much of the toxicity of those types of relationships, like strangely accurately portrayed. I thought it was bizarrely accurate at times, so it certainly can happen. It wasn't a positive portrayal of queer culture, but it was like in some ways I was like, oh wow, yeah, I've definitely been in toxic relationships with women that kind of look like this.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So I am going to read the synopsis of But I'm a Cheerleader for the people who have not seen it. Megan, played by Natasha Lyonne, considers herself a typical American girl. She excels in school and cheerleading. She has a handsome football-playing boyfriend, even though she isn't crazy about him. So she's stunned when her parents decide she's gay and send her to True Directions, a boot camp meant to alter her sexual orientation. While there, Megan meets a rebellious and unashamed teen lesbian, Graham, played by Clea DuVall. Though Megan still feels confused, she starts to have feelings for Graham. The story is by Jamie Babbitt, screenplay by Brian Wayne Peterson, and it was directed by Jamie Babbitt as well. But I'm a Cheerleader opened at the Toronto International Film Festival on September 12th, 1999. It had a limited release on July 7th, 2000. It would go on to make $2.6 million on a $1 million budget. But I'm a Cheerleader has 39% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 74% from audiences.
What Ebert's was the critic number? 39. Unbelievable.
That's what?
Yeah.
Y'all are
This is
high.
What I mean, which is that at the time, this movie was just not... People didn't get it. They
That's
put her
fine.
In a they,
whatever. Fuck them.
You fuck them 100%. But like they put her in a pool with sort of with John Waters, who also, if we're being honest, was not a critical darling.
Yeah.
And it just sort of they were like, oh yeah, she's doing this, and just. But what's interesting is that you know you see the 74% from audiences, which just goes to show that like there were people that loved this movie. Twice mm-hmm. as many people, in fact.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Ebert's review, he gave it 3 out of 4 stars, or 2.5, or I think it was 3, sorry. He said, But I'm a Cheerleader is not a great breakout comedy, but it's a kind of movie that might eventually become a regular on midnight cult circuit. It feels like an amateur night version of itself, awkward, heartfelt, and sweet. I want to read a little bit of, there was a really great piece in Little White Lies that was done back in 2018 about this film that I want to read really quickly. J.B. Babbitt's satire is a powerful tool to deconstruct heteronormativity and conversion therapy's dangerous central premise that same-sex attraction is an illness that needs to be cured. This campy approach also informs the set design and saturated high-contrast cinematography, which combine to create a rich visual language reminiscent of John Waters. While the similarities to Waters' aesthetic would lead to negative critical feedback from the likes of Roger Ebert, colorful production design and costume are fundamental to Babbitt's critique. As she...
Sorry.
That was amazing.
That was water.
That was the loudest water I've ever heard.
I put it like below the table. And I thought that would help, but it just amplified it.
Have you guys been able to hear me drink my coffee this whole time?
No.
Yeah.
What? I mean, sort of.
It's iced coffee. That's why I was wondering, but yeah.
As Babbitt explained in an interview with the U.S. LGBT newspaper, The Advocate, I wanted to make the world of the movie feel artificial and polyester. I think it's a great comment on the artificiality of gender identity. It's also worth noting how Babbitt's style diverges from Waters, taking brash camp sensibility and intrigue and integrating it with teen romantic comedy, one with a happy ending, no less. She champions a femme lesbian aesthetic on screen, filtering popular culture, female culture through a queer lens. She anticipates later cult lesbian films and strikes a blow against the femme invisibility that is, which still permeates the lesbian community and afflicts representation of lesbians in mainstream cinema. In the context of the late 90s, Babbitt boldly paved the way for greater LGBT representation in film. Despite mixed reviews and limited distribution, But I'm a Cheerleader has endured among the LGBT community due to its fervent rejection of heteronormativity and its celebration of queerness at each stage of production, in the storyline, the aesthetic, the cast, and the crew. I think that it was obviously important to read something from recently to see how this film has grown in its esteem, how important this movie is in queer cinema. But it's interesting to see Ebert's review, which is positive, but also, you know, couched in this idea of, you know, patting it on the head and being like, you'll be a cute little cult movie in the future, which is, you know, patronizing.
So I just looked up the Metacritic score of Boys mm-hmm. Don't Cry, and it's 86%. And mm-hmm. I think that speaks to like kind of what we were talking about earlier and just how
important dramas are.
Well, not important, but just like how people like need gay people to be sad. Like for it to be like a serious movie. Yes. And like, I think that honestly, like, gay people being happy was just something critics didn't know what to do with. Like, I think like a gay person dying was totally fine with them, yeah. or a trans person dying. That was cool, like, because they're suffering. And like, I think that there's a whole other psychological aspect to that that is dark to me.
This is true for every marginalized community in America.
Yeah. And the slave narrative in black cinema and like how like that will definitely like get an Oscar, but like
poverty
black
narrative.
People being happy is like never like critically acclaimed.
It's a very specific kind of trauma that it seems like high-minded liberal audiences want to see.
Right.
And that's to me, you know, we've talked about it before, but that's why Moonlight is so revolutionary, because it's neither fish nor fowl, right? Moonlight is about trauma, but it's not about race trauma explicitly, right? The story of Moonlight getting made is about
intersectional. Race.
Of course, necessarily so. Necessarily so, but you know, the primary narrative is, to me at least, about his self-acceptance, coming out, trauma associated with that.
Yeah, but doing so in the Black community has its own challenges, and the experience of that, especially in a rural town, I think is something that the movie explores. I'm going to disagree with you on that. I think that it is a specifically Black queer film.
We're saying different things. I should have set it up a different way. The narrative that I think white audiences, or you know, mainstream audiences have been comfortable with is the narrative that you were talking about, the slave narrative that turned into a poverty narrative, turned into a, you know, an underclass narrative.
Mm-hmm.
The narrative presented in Moonlight is not of that to me. It is certainly a Black film. I'm no way saying it's not a Black film. And the brilliance of it is, to me, that it explores something very specific within the Black community, but it is not your typical rising up from poverty
narrative
associated with these kind of prestige Black movies, you know, whether you're talking about movies like 12 Years a Slave, or whether you're talking about even shows like The Wire, where this is where we put our focus when it comes to Black cinema.
Right.
With gay cinema, it's the exact same thing you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There is this idea that suffering is intrinsic to that narrative.
Yeah.
And suffering, right? At all times, like pain, sometimes physical pain, sometimes rape, things that are just horrible and horror that really have a way of Trojan horsing into your brain this idea that being gay is dangerous for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Being gay is something that could eventually hurt you. And I don't think
and
that
kill you.
And kill you.
In the case of Boys Don't Cry, or like cry, being trans, will kill you.
I mean, like, there is this idea that, and I don't think that, you know, look, I know that Kimberly Pierce and Jonathan Demme, for instance, were not, you know, were not malicious filmmakers in any sense. These people are, you know, and Kimberly Pierce is a gay icon, and Jonathan Demme, a well-known ally, very, you know, wonderful human beings.
Yeah.
But it's hard to break out of these narratives. And I think that might be why, to your point, Lola, this is a unusual film. And this is probably very hard for people.
And like, if I can get into like my own sort of like personal background going into this film, like I think early 90s, I hadn't faced a lot of homophobia as a person, because like I quote unquote, like, past. I think that there was a way in which like I could sort of get away with not getting bullied for it. But I do feel like, so, but in the early 90s, I moved from Ireland to America, or even before, Ireland to America, early 90s, I actually became like, I was like so obsessed with Americana, and I like met these girls, and they were like the most American girls, and they had a cheer squad, and I joined the cheer squad, and I was a legit cheerleader, and I felt like I am American. I am a girl. Like, look at me being a girl. I am attracted to boys only. Trust me. Like, meanwhile, like, I was completely checking out all of That's the girls. Right. And so what ended up happening with that group of friends is, I do, to this day, I have no idea where this came from, but these were like my best friends. We'd have sleepover parties all of the time. And I like got completely dropped by them because someone started a rumor that I was a lesbian witch. And I was called into the principal's office. I kid you not, this was a Catholic school. And Sister Stella called me into the principal's office and asked me legitimately if I was practicing witchcraft and unsavory acts. And all of those cheer girls like stopped talking to me overnight.
Oh,
and
God.
At that point, I was not, it was this weird thing of like, I have never kissed a girl. I have never, like, I had not admitted that to myself, but like, somehow there was a reality there. There, like, somehow I had been perceived. I wasn't into witchcraft at the time, but should I tell the story or no?
I mean, you can tell. I mean, listen,
this is
witchcraft.
Why we're here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is why we're here.
But so like I, out of homophobia, like I lost all of my friend groups like overnight. And that's like without even coming out.
Yeah.
I immediately was like, okay, this is dangerous to come out. There's a whole other thing with which, well, this is actually a queer story. So like there was this rumor that I was practicing witchcraft. At the time, I was not at all. I had no idea. Like I had not seen the craft yet. Later, I would watch it on repeat as pornography. So like there was this rumor going around the schoolyard that I was a witch, and this girl came up to me who was like the hottest goth. She was just like so attractive. And she came up to me and she was like, "Hey, I hear you're a witch. Do you want to cast some spells?" And I was like, "Yes, I am a witch. I am 100% a witch. Let's cast some motherfucking spells." When do you want me to come over? So I ended up like having this like relationship with this girl, and we got into like witchcraft just out of my like pure lust for her.
This is a great story.
And then we did a binding spell on the cheerleader girls. Mm-hmm. Together. We did watch The Craft together, I think, at that point.
Sure.
And weirdly, they all I was also like, I strangely like became friends with Nikki Hilton because she went to that school. And that's like a whole other side story. But
is that LA or New York?
Yeah, this is LA. I moved from Galway, Ireland to like LA. And then, or no, maybe I had transferred from LA. I was back and forth between Ireland and LA a lot at that point. But like, so. Then, so like we did the binding spell, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, all of the cheer girls were like, "We're really sorry we were mean to you." And binding is like to make people nicer. And then it all ended
up. So it worked,
up.
Is what you're
saying. Yeah, it worked.
So witchcraft is real.
I definitely wasn't allowed to be a lesbian. So like I definitely kept that under wraps. And then I will never forget, this was like such a formative memory, but I was in Ireland the next year. And I was on a bus, I was on a school bus, and I was, there was this, and this is Galway, which is like a very small town, super Catholic. In the mid-90s, like, we were not friendly to gays. I mean, and like women especially, like, there's all sorts of history there. But now we're much more progressive. We recently had a gay Taoiseach, but like, at the time, super homophobic. But I was on the bus, and there was these two women. And I remember I saw them and like my whole body, my whole like 13-year-old body, like head to toe, horripilated, like goosebumps. I was like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Like these two women were holding hands. Like, and we're also like not big on PDAs in Ireland. So even just seeing like people like affectionate and just like visibly in love was just so affecting. I was just like, I want that. And one of like the kids on the bus was like, saw them and started screaming dyke at them. And like, and the whole bus full of kids like started like screaming all of this stuff, like about going to hell. And just like, just imagine like a car full of like all of that, just hate. And I was just at the back of the bus, and I remember like biting my lip so I wouldn't cry and walking home. And I knew that I was also attracted to boys. So I think I like really was like, okay, I'm not going to do that. Like, I'm going to just like ignore that part, right, as much as I can. But of course, like repression doesn't work. So that was kind of like my backstory going into coming back to high school. And oh, and then another experience I had was this girl called me a dyke in a locker room. And I was not out and did not like admit that. And, but at that time I did have a secret girlfriend, but like nobody knew about it. It was super top secret. And I was like pretending I had like beard boyfriends and like, so there was like all, like every experience I had was either like in secret behind closed doors or it was like just very negative. And this is like in LA too. Yeah. And I had a queer theory, like cinema studies mom. And I had like such an accepting, like I had such an opportunity for it to be okay. But like, that wasn't my experience. I had like, just anytime it would come up, it would just be scary. So then I went and saw this movie. And also like I saw Boys Don't Cry. And sure. I even had like gender curiosity back then. And I was like, I don't always feel like a girl. Like, and I saw that and I was like, bah! Like I'm going to die, you know? And I feel like all of those depictions of like being queer, just being like very scary and dangerous in cinema was really had an effect on me because, and I didn't even realize it until I saw But I'm a Cheerleader because I realized how much relief I felt, like the relief of laughing and feeling love and like feeling all of this stuff that I had craved was there. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know I was hungry for this. I didn't even know I needed this so badly, but I did. I did need to see that, like, it's okay. Not only is it okay, it can be beautiful.
Yeah. It's a really heartfelt movie. I mean, it's overflowing with love for all of its characters. I want to sort of just hit some of the plot points. We've hit a bunch of them, but I really love the credits at the beginning with the April March cover of Chick Habit.
Oh my god, so good!
Which is so good. Michelle Williams showing up as the head cheerleader up top. You know, between this and Dick, I really hope she starts. I wish she did more comedies. Not that she's not a great dramatic actress, but she's so fucking funny.
She's so funny.
She's so great. I'd love to see her do more of those. Bud Cort shows up playing Megan's dad. Basically, we meet Megan. She's at high school. She's dating this football player named Jared. They make out in the car, as we mentioned, and it's so uncomfortable and so gross, and there's so much tongue going on. But then I also was like, kissing is so weird. Like watching that scene, it just made me feel like kissing's such a strange thing. But that's neither here.
But then you see the kissing later on, and you're like,
ooh, yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah,
it's but good. It's like it's kissing. So grotesque and funny, and like that she's like thinking of her of all the shots that it was. I thought also just like the opening sequence. Can we talk about how she just like reclaimed these like cheerleader movies, which were so popular back in the 90s, and she made them through a female gaze in this, like, she took this like very male gazy type of thing
100%
and turned it into this. I loved how she did that.
It's really, I mean, one of the bigger things, and we've talked about this a little bit, but you know, it's a very specific aesthetic. There's a vision to it. The heightened quality of the world once she gets to True Directions has a very, like, I actually, my brain went more to Tim Burton than it did to John Waters.
Yeah, lists him as a big influence. Edward Scissorhands, which I think is so interesting. Like, I was like, yes. And I was obsessed with that movie. And I think, like, he's a weirdly, like, queer, he's a queer icon just because of his otherness.
Yes.
Like, he's.
That's the thing. Yeah. It's the otherness. Because I'm, all right, so Bud Cort is not in this movie by accident. And Bud Cort is best known for Harold and Maude. And Harold and Maude is not about a gay couple, but Harold and Maude is about an other type of couple. And I think that's why he fits into this tapestry of kind of, it's othered cinema. I don't know how else to put it. But yes.
People on the fringe, people that feel like they don't fit in some way or another. And then, I mean, obviously, then we have RuPaul, who shows up as a quote-unquote ex-gay.
Wearing a shirt that's as straight as gay, or I can't, sorry, I'm dyslexic and bisexual.
Straight is great. Yeah. yeah, so he shows up and they do this sort of surprise intervention.
Has anyone had a better 20 years than RuPaul?
I don't know, man.
It's unbelievable.
Basically following this intervention, Megan is sent to True Directions, which is this, as we've said, a sort of a group therapy conversion camp, where she meets Mary Brown, played by Kathy Moriarty, who is running this place with her supposedly heterosexual son, Rock, played by Eddie Cibrian. One of Eddie Cibrian's better performances. I'm not the biggest Eddie Cibrian fan in the world, but he's really funny in this, I thought.
Rock, obviously not, you know, not a randomly named character.
Not randomly
Rock
named.
Rock Hudson, yeah.
We meet Melanie Lynskey playing Hillary Vandermeuler with her Australian accent, which is amazing, or her New Zealand accent.
One of the first notes I took were more roles for Melanie Lynskey with her accent.
Right?
Oh my God, she's
such
so
a great accent.
Good.
I love it.
And
love,
she was also like well known as sort of a queer icon because of her breakout role, which is about a sort of
In Heavenly Creatures.
Yeah, toxically codependent.
Do you think that was slightly toxically codependent? That they murdered Melanie Lynskey's mom with a rock?
Repression is dangerous. Don't do it.
Yeah, be your true self.
Be your true self, or someone might get murdered.
But yeah, it's interesting. So we then meet Graham Eaton, played by Clea Duvall, and Natasha Lyonne in that interview talks about how Clea had this. Is it Clea? I think it's Clea, right?
Yeah,
or Clea. Clea. How she had this James Dean-esque kind of bravado about her, this not bravado is the wrong word, but just this persona or what have you. She's just so fucking cool. She's effortlessly cool from like the second you meet her. And I wish that, I mean, Clea is now doing a lot of writing and directing of her own. So is Natasha Lyonne. But it's just interesting how from the second you see Graham, I was just like, oh, so Graham's the coolest person ever. And I, you know, who wouldn't want to date Graham? Like, she's just awesome. We're then introduced to sort of this 5-step program, which is kind of used as a framework or a narrative structure for the rest of the film, of these sort of steps that they have to go through towards becoming not gay or whatever it is. But the first step is that Megan has to admit her homosexuality to the group. Which is an amazing scene. Natasha's amazing in it. Just sort of this like emotional roller coaster that she goes through in the span of like 2 minutes as she sort of has to find herself admitting to this thing. The drooling, however, is kind of it's something special. It's amazing.
I loved the drooling.
The drooling's amazing.
Yeah. Like, and only like a female queer director, I feel like, would do that. Like, I feel like that was, yeah, it was distinct. Like, I feel like I had never seen a like romantic lead be allowed, a female romantic lead allowed, mm-hmm. be allowed to be gross, like, yeah. and human yeah. in that yeah. way. I thought it was like mind boggling.
It's also, I mean, we've talked a lot about, you know, about Clea, what have you, but Natasha Lyonne's performance in this movie is fucking phenomenal.
So good. I think it's her best work. And I don't, that's not a knock at all.
Oh, 100%. I think that she came into this and, you know, there's a lot of quotes from her talking about how, you know, she was dating Edward Furlong at the time. She was wearing, you know, going to Marilyn Manson concert. and she was, you know, she was much more in the sort of like goth punk rock kind of crowd. So for her, this idea of playing this blonde haired, you know,
girly
cheerleader, she saw it as like taking the piss out of a persona. Yeah. But the way that she brings such humanity and such depth to this character,
yeah.
which really could have been done in a stereotypical way, is really something special.
I think she does nail that like really earnest, wide-eyed sensibility, though. And that's why I think I'm so impressed by that performance, is that she is so grounded and sardonic and clever. Like, she's so witty as a, like, yeah. and she generally just like plays that type. But seeing her really take on this like very wide-eyed, like sweet person was just delightful.
Totally. And it's interesting. Yes, sir. Go ahead, Kenny.
I think she's great too. It's not my favorite performance. I like. It's great, and I'm happy that she did it, and I'm happy that, you know, she showed she can do it. But I think what she does, particularly in Russian Doll, is just, like, so mesmerizing to me. She's such a leading lady. She's such a protagonist. She's such a main character.
Yeah.
And I love, like, I didn't think Russian Doll was all that great. I just loved watching her. The whole time
you want to go on a journey with her is the thing, like no matter what she's in
and real and just she's amazing in that show. You know, and I mean, I think, you know, I think that Natasha Lyonne should just kind of be given, you know, the old Woody Allen treatment. Give her, you know,
whatever she wants.
Give her $5 million and tell her to do something every year, and I would kill to see it. But
it's so interesting because when you put this performance in But I'm a Cheerleader, which I do think is fantastic, next to her performance in American Pie in 99, and you're just like, oh, so you completely wasted Natasha Lyonne in American Pie. Like, she's just you know what I mean? She's playing such a truthfully what ultimately becomes sort of tropey for her, which is like the kind of sardonic, weird best friend kind of bullshit, which just wastes so much talent. I mean, you can see that A, she can hold a movie, she can be a leading role, and she's just, there's so many gears to her, which I think is just is really incredible.
Yeah, and I think that sort of speaks to that box thing we were talking about earlier, where it's like, I think people just decided she was a quote unquote tomboy. Like, people just like really, and I love that Jamie Babbitt wasn't scared to just allow her to be a completely femme, like completely off type. I think casting can be a bit prohibitive to women in that way of like, if you don't fit like this particular mold, then you are automatically like this type. And I just love that departure for her and how she really took it on. I feel like without a lot of judgment. Like, I think that knowing that she is this like sardonic type of person, like, she just really inhabited that worldview in a really lovely way.
I totally agree. I think she also, so apparently she was not the first choice for the role. I don't know who the actor was, but there was someone that was like, oh, I can't do this for religious reasons, it seemed like. And Jamie in an interview didn't say who the actor was. I don't know if you were able to find out who it was, Lola, but
she's always been tight-lipped about that.
Yeah, but the person like auditioned and like they got pretty far down the road, and then the person pulled the plug saying that she was too religious to do the movie. And from all intents and purposes, it looks like Clea was the person that teed up Natasha to Jamie. So I think that's really interesting.
She found the script in the back of Clea's car,
which I love. Is the best.
it's good. Like Clea, so I guess, like helped cast the movie.
Basically, like Melanie Lynskey is friends with them as well. Like it just feels like it doesn't. Yeah. So Lola and I talked about a character a little bit on text, and this character shows up now at this point. Megan wakes up in the middle of the night to the sound of Sinead zapping herself under the sheets with a taser to inappropriate thoughts. I personally didn't hate the performance of Sinead, but I think Lola has thoughts.
Go for it.
You're just going to throw me under the bus like that. I just feel like Catherine Town was the only person who was miscast in this movie. I don't have any like feelings against her as like, I just felt like she was very, like she was on Buffy, like she's just very WB, and like I didn't buy her as a goth. Like I thought that like, I was just sort of like, you really can't find like a goth queer girl in Hollywood in the 90s. It just was like, what? It just felt like a WB girl with like eyeliner on. And of course, like Sinead is kind of loathsome as a character. So maybe she did an amazing job and that's why I hated her. She's such a narc.
I do think that this, it does tap into something you were saying, though. And I agree with you in one way, which is that I think that Across the board, I think it's very well cast. I think that everybody in the movie is quite good.
Brilliant.
Brilliantly cast. But it's such it's a high wire act of tone, right? In terms of keeping these characters from tipping into caricature.
Right.
And I think that to your point, it's possible, I didn't feel it as much, but you did anyway, which is completely justified and fair, that Sinead tips into caricature, that she doesn't feel fully fleshed out. And perhaps it is that Catherine just kind of goes a little too broadly with it, or whatever the case might be. You know, she is a loathsome character. I guess I just bought the aesthetic of... And as I've said on previous podcasts, I wish I was a goth in high school. So I think I was just looking at Sinead and being like,
"You could still be a goth."
I think that ship has sailed, but I appreciate that. but my point more than anything is that the Sinead character is intrinsic to the plot, right? She keeps things moving, and she, you know, she's the mustache twirling villain, for lack of a better way of putting it. And
she's the third spoke in the love triangle, too. She is. I don't know. Yeah. I didn't think much of it, but I'm probably, you know, I probably didn't put enough thought into it. She seems fine to me.
Yeah, but I mean, she's also like in this cast of just people who I think were perfectly cast and just did an incredible job of that high wire of just like being in a satire, but not going so broad that they're unbelievable. So I think like, yeah, she was in this pool of people who were just perfect. And I feel like she was a little too broad and like not right for her role.
I hear that.
Yeah. But maybe just, to your point, the mustache twirling villain like can be a bit more broad. So, you know, that's my personal preference. I felt like I wanted like a Fairuza Balk type person in that
who doesn't
role.
Always want Fairuza Balk? I mean, she's always great. So Mary gets a phone call from her parents who check in, and we get this really great split screen moment of her on the phone while Mary's playing an acoustic guitar in the background.
It's so good.
It's so good.
It's so good. It's so it's fantastic. It's wonderful. Then we have step two, which is rediscovering their gender identity by performing stereotypical gender associated tasks. Mm-hmm. I adore the vacuum scene. I fucking love the way it looks with these crazy brightly colored plastic gloves and the vacuums and
the raking is also
and the
amazing.
Raking. And like, it's great.
The stuff in the background. Like there's just so much even production design that has that in it. Like the gun that just like looks like a dick.
On the boy side. It's even more. It's over amazing. The boy stuff is amazing.
Yeah.
And
RuPaul
can really throw a football. Like he worked very hard at that.
But yeah, so Mike teaches the boys how to fix a car and like how
drop
to like
wood.
Drop wood.
Chop wood.
Chop wood, that is sorry. It's really funny. then
he specifically
step three
teaches
is
not how to drop wood.
Yes, that. Yes, yeah. Step three is finding the root of their homosexuality through family therapy. So they do this. Megan has a sex dream about Graham. And then they do this sort of group therapy with family where we meet all the parents of a lot of these kids. Then we have the scene that got this an NC-17 rating that had to be recut to get an R rating, which is Megan has this sex dream and then sort of goes into Mary's office and starts to masturbate. And the shot, I guess, was sort of like a cowboy shot. So it was like a somewhat wider shot. So you could actually see where her hand was. And that was what got it an NC-17 rating, which is truly absurd when you think of the things that got
like
NC-17.
Pie.
Like American Pie, for instance. Like you can fuck a pie. Well, you can literally fuck a pie.
What?
Nothing wrong with fucking a pie.
Don't masturbate.
You know, I don't. Fuck a pie. It's not very offensive.
Well, I mean, I wasn't suggesting it was offensive to me, but the MPAA had issues with it. So, but more importantly, perhaps, is that she sees Dolph and Clayton making out, and she screams at their discovery.
so good, by the way. I felt that moment, I thought, mm-hmm. was such a beautiful criticism of homophobia within gay people. It's just this tiny moment. And I think, like, just in that tiny moment, she reveals so much about how inherent homophobia is, even if you're gay. Anyway.
It's fantastic. It's a great moment. She panics, she screams, and then Dolph is made to leave. Like, he's kicked out of the camp. And Clayton is punished by being put in a tiny pink church/doghouse in the front yard.
Yes. Did anyone feel like it was significant that the person of color was removed and the white person was not?
I did think of that.
Yeah.
They both got pretty bad punishments. I think the solitary confinement in the doghouse is pretty terrible. And I think he was in there for like a week.
It's a big put in the hole.
Like, the white boy gets put in this like dollhouse normalized into like white heteronormative society. And the person of color is like, no, you don't belong here. You failed. Get out of here.
I
don't know. I found that significant.
I feel you, and I'm kind of always on the lookout for that stuff. I think I may have been more uncomfortable if it was the other way around. If you put Dolph in the doghouse for a week, it's a terrible punishment. I don't know. That didn't quite hit me that's the same way.
I thought that the doghouse was obviously a terrible punishment and also made me laugh. Just in terms of the absurdity of like the visuals of it. I also had
that felt
all
very
I could think of
to me, yeah.
Yes. Yes. I also feel like the only thing I could think of with the guy who played Dolph, Dante Basco, is obviously Rufio from Hook. Mm-hmm. So I made that association. So at this point, the True Direction kids are encouraged to rebel against Mary by two former students, ex-gays, Larry and Lloyd, played by Richard Mall and Wesley Mann.
I want to just point out how much you just laughed, Kenny, and you had the audacity to say this wasn't a comedy. And you're just laughing, like, retelling this is a really funny movie.
And little bits like XX Gay is so funny to me. I mean, RuPaul had a line right in the beginning that I wrote down, which I love. That sets up the whole movie for me. He goes, "I myself was once a gay. Now I am an ex-gay." And that felt particularly from his mouth. It was like it is like extremely funny, but like
it is.
It's also, you know, I don't know. It also has this like the only movie that I could think of that felt like the romance was Cruel Intentions. Like they're similar in like. Everything is so ridiculous in Cruel Intentions, except for the scenes of Reese and Ryan, like, together.
Yeah, they're super earnest, those scenes.
They're played so earnestly. That's right. And the movie doesn't work unless you do it that way.
Yeah,
right?
I agree
so
with
there,
that.
It's
yeah.
a, there is a similarity in terms of structure where, you know, the brand of absurdity the movie uses is extremely mm-hmm. different. But yeah, the earnestness at the center serves to sell the relationship as the one bit of normalcy within this otherwise insane world.
And it also it undercuts it a little bit. It rounds the edges off of it a little bit, and it makes it by comparison seem slightly more. So so Larry and Lloyd take the kids to a local gay bar where Julie Delpy shows up, which is awesome.
Man.
Yeah.
So hot.
Yeah, she's very hot.
Yeah, no, Julie Delpy is the best.
Does she have a I don't think she
It also should
line.
Be said that Richard Mall will like always be Bull from Night Court.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
She doesn't have a line. She doesn't.
What did you say? I
didn't hear that. From Night Court. Does she have a line? I was going to say that Bull from Night Court is the guy who plays Larry, I believe. But that's neither here nor there.
That's right.
I don't know that Julie Delpy has a line, but does she have a line? Do you think she does?
I don't know if I like invented a line in my fantasies or if it's in the actual film. I don't know if she has a line. Maybe she doesn't.
Is Julie Delpy someone who would be considered a gay icon in anyone's opinion?
I don't know.
Or is he just like a super hot, sexy human being who...
I think she's a super hot, sexy human being.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of... She hasn't showed up in anything else in 99 for us yet, has she? Am I crazy?
I don't think she has.
I'm just looking
around. It's an interesting decision to use her as the vessel of attractiveness within the context of this gay bar. That just, I don't know. It's no judgment on that. That's just an interesting thing to me, particularly, you know, because it's Natasha Lyonne getting kind of pulled into this world, and the person she's attracted to is James Dean and not, you know.
Yeah, I mean, she's not really in anything in 99 except this, and her character's name is Lipstick Lesbian on IMDb. Mm-hmm. So
their parents knew.
Yeah.
I don't think she's seen as like the, I mean, I happen to think she's sexy, but like, she's, I don't think she's, she's not sold in the storyline as someone who's so alluring that she causes any kind of drama. She's sort of like thrown away by everyone, in fact.
I'm still kind of trying to figure out exactly what purpose she serves, but
it's
pretty cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't quite know. When she popped up, I was like, "Oh, Julie Delpy's in this," and then they don't really do anything with it. Which maybe I don't know. Maybe, I mean, who knows? It's hard to say.
But she wasn't big then, right? Was she?
Well, I mean, she does Before Sunrise in '95. Yeah.
I didn't know it was in '95.
But she I mean, I just kind of skimmed through her IMDb. She was in a little bit of a fallow period at that point. It felt like she wasn't doing a bunch of stuff. And then in 2004, Before Sunset comes out, and it kind of rejuvenates a little bit off of that. But I don't know. So at this point, Mary finds out about them going to this gay bar, and she forces them to picket Larry and Lloyd's house. And then Megan and Graham pretend to be into men at this point, but also sneak away to have sex together. And we have our sort of their sex scene, which is really beautiful. And really, I really love the way it was filmed. But I also think it's funny that Clea and Natasha both said that they were such prudes that they didn't want to really do anything. That's why like they're fully clothed and it's really just like kissing and what have you. Which I actually
think was not out at that point too.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So it's I actually think that the chasteness of it adds to how genuine and pretty and beautiful that the mm-hmm. sexiness. But I also love how Megan loves cheering and Graham desperately says she wants to see her cheer. Like that this there's this that, sorry. That that
sorry guys
that there's this sort of this thing about her that's not a secret but that Graham hasn't seen, that this sort of like talent of hers or this love that she has that Graham really wants to see, which I think
I like that she makes fun of it initially and that Megan stands her ground, and I feel like that's the moment of attraction, at least that's how I've always perceived it, is that she sticks up for herself and says, no, like, don't make fun of cheer. It's actually great. And like, she sort of is like, I love this thing. Fuck off.
Yeah, no, 100%.
And I think that Graham sees that grit and that ability to stick up for herself, even though she's like super femme and all of these things, as the attractive thing in a way.
No, I totally agree. And I think that actually speaks to sort of this. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
The one thing I wanted to mention was that the reason that Graham is acting straight is because that's the way out of there. You know, she's clearly deduced that, you know, that there's a way to get out of True Directions, and that's by passing. And it really kind of contributes to this notion that
I think what society would prefer from these people is for them to pass as straight as mm-hmm. opposed to live their true lives and be gay. And that's kind of the, you know, the insidious underbelly of these programs.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so much insidious underbelly.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
It's all insidious underbelly.
Yeah, it's pretty much
It's also, I mean, this also kind of feeds into where we're at sort of in the plot, which is that Megan at this point has shown, you know, is unrepentant, is owning her sexual identity. And because of that, she's shown the door. So this idea that it's sort of, you know, flipping or turning this on its head a little bit, that the character that was so sort of that owned her identity up top is now, you know, hiding it, for lack of a better way of putting it, and pretending to be straight in order to get out of there.
I also think there's this, yeah, there's that sort of point at privilege too, mm-hmm. and like how so many rich kids will not come out because they right. have these huge trust funds, and there's so much more for that. They perceive there's more to lose there, right. and that is something that I have seen so much. Mm-hmm. That like rich kids who are very codependent on their parents will not come out and go to these conversion therapy camps and try to, as you say, pass because they're so attached to their privilege.
Do you think that's true today still?
Yeah, I personally yeah. know someone who's like, tragic.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So at this point, Megan leaves True Direction. She's homeless. She stays with Larry and Lloyd, the XX gays. And Graham, afraid to defy her father, remains at the camp. Basically, Megan and Dolph, who are living with Larry and Lloyd, plan to win Graham and win back Graham and Clayton. And now we have step five, which is basically Mary makes Graham make out with Rock as a step five simulating heterosexual intercourse.
Yeah, can we talk about that?
Yeah,
and how yeah. they're wearing these like unitards of Adam and Eve, and it's yeah. just like peak camp satire. I love that scene. I like was rolling, like I think I fell out of my chair laughing, and just like how, because it just like points to the absurdity yeah. of like heteronormative sort of gender identity and how you're supposed to do it all. And like they're wearing these flesh colored unitards with like felt leaves. Fig leaves on the genitalia. Yeah. It's so prude, but also sexual in this like weird mm-hmm. Victorian way.
Totally.
Yep. There's this weird like box, I think, in like heteronormative society, particularly when it comes to the education of children. That mm-hmm. is all the sex stuff.
Sure.
Right? And they keep it all in there for most of your childhood and adolescence. Like, we're not going to tell you about this sex stuff. That's why R-rated movies, you know, that's why movies with sexual content are R, but movies with, you know, people getting, you know, spears to the face are PG-13.
Yeah, yeah.
For instance, I love the idea that, like, they open this box when there's an emergency. You know, like break glass in case of emergency. Like, we are losing these people. Show them some of the sex shit. See you there. Like, that will get them back if we show yes. them the sex yeah. shit. So, and this is yeah. what they got for it. They got unitards yeah. with fig leaves and simulated sex.
But it's also so neutered. Like, it's yeah. so, like, antisexual.
Yeah. And like, ultimately, they don't know shit because they were raised in the same society that kept all the sex shit in a box. So yeah. they don't know anything, you know?
It's amazing. It's great. It's amazing. Yeah.
It's so funny.
So then Megan and Dolph infiltrate True Direction's graduation ceremony, where Dolph easily coaxes Clayton away. And Megan basically tries to get Graham to join as well, but Graham nervously declines. And then Megan performs a cheer for Graham and tells her that she loves her, and finally winning Graham over. The cheer is so lovely.
It is so lovely. So it's one of my favorite moments in cinema history.
It's so good. And like, I was texting Lola as I was watching, as I said, I've never seen the film before. And like, it made me cry. Like, it's a really, really beautiful moment. It's really, really touching. Mm-hmm. And then they drive off together with Dolph and Clayton. in the back of a pickup. Yeah. And the final scene is Megan's parents attending a PFLAG meeting to come to terms with their daughter's homosexuality.
And even in that last moment, the dad is there for it, but the mom is embarrassed. And I thought that was such a, like, I love that she just commits to the murkiness of it, like, from beginning to end. It was just, I thought that was such a great choice.
It's a great, it's a great button for the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great movie. I'm gonna go ahead and do my rating. As I said, I hadn't seen it in 99, so this is really just this time. Before the podcast, I probably would have given it like a 79 or an 80, and now I think I'm at like an 84 or an 85. Like I really just think it's a really special movie, and I want to just sort of kind of jump back for a quick second and just say, you know, looking at that Rotten Tomatoes scores, I think a lot of it really has to do with something you said, Kenny, and obviously you said too, Lola, which is because this film does not fit in a box, that it is not easily defined, that it goes out of its way to make sure that it cannot be defined, is part of the reason I think that this film didn't hit with critics. I think they just needed this film to clearly define itself, which it was going out of its way not to do. And I think the critics, because of that, were like, well, I don't know what this is. And it's some, you know, weird little indie movie. And I, they just didn't take the time to really look under the hood and to dig into this movie. And I think it's a sign perhaps of the times back then, but I'm so thrilled that this movie has found sort of, with some time, has found the love that it deserves.
You want me to go, Lola, or do you want to go?
Sure. And it's out of 100, right?
Yes, yeah, 99.
Oh, out of 99.
Yeah.
I would give it a 99 all across the board, but this movie really felt like it was made for me, and I'm a hard to define person who doesn't fit in a box, and like everything about it just makes me so full of glee. I think it's just so clever, and I think the production design is delightful, and I think it's a 99 for me. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. So
this is your favorite movie of 1999.
Yeah, absolutely, hands down.
Do you know what your second favorite movie is?
That one's tough for me. God, I don't know if I have the answer handy for that.
Okay.
Sorry to disappoint.
Next time you're on.
Next time when
not
you come back.
Angela's Ashes.
Not Angela's Ashes.
Not
Phil, I was right there with you, buddy. I was 80. I gave it an 80 coming into the podcast. I'm tempted to bump it up a little bit because I know what I was hesitant to go any higher on was that I thought the plotting was a little easy, and there were some things that I felt were a little unearned from a plotting and narrative perspective. But like in the discussion of the movie, that didn't seem to matter at all. Like I don't even remember what those things are at this point. Obviously, it wasn't important. I'm going to go up to an 85. I think it's I think it's one of the best movies we covered. Just a great movie. So
it really is. I not to belabor the point, but I'll just say, you know, it's it annoys me that I dismissed it back in the day and that I just didn't really give it its due. And listen, this has happened with a handful of movies, not just this movie. I mean, Kenny and I have watched movies that we've never seen before for this podcast and been blown away and just assumed that they were that they weren't worth, quote unquote, worth our time back then, and now are just fucking legitimately fantastic movies. And this is one of those moments where I'm so thrilled that we do the podcast. You know, that it's that it forces me to watch movies that I haven't watched before. And you know, this is such a gem of a movie. Really, really happy that not just that we had you on for it, Lola, obviously, but just to be able to really dig into it. It's a really special movie. I hope that people seek it out.
Yeah, watch it a million times. And it's not just a queer movie. I think like that's another thing that I'm so happy that people are starting to watch it, because I think like it, what it says about love is so universal, and what it, I think the relationship ideals of it could really help people so much. You know, 100%. It is a rom-com that has such a like a self-love at its core and self-acceptance at its core. And I think regardless of who you are or what you are, whatever, whatever's going on, it really advocates for a healthy and really fulfilling kind of romance. And I think that's beautiful for anyone.
I was going to say something similar, which is
agreed.
I don't think I knew I would like this movie, or I had a strong feeling that I would like this movie because of how much people seem to like this movie. If that makes any sense. Like when people ride so hard for something that, you know, is under the radar, I'm usually very excited to see that movie because of it, you know, hits so hard with some people. Watching it now, to your point, Lola, about it not just being a queer movie, I couldn't imagine anyone else. Like that's really what I feel like right now is like, I certainly like, I couldn't imagine a critic not liking it, but you know, I would imagine that my parents would like it. I would imagine that people I know from growing up would like it. I think it has a lot of, you know, we did Election very recently, and I think last week, right, Phil? Mm-hmm. And I think that it has a lot of that Election DNA, which is there is a lot there for people who are predisposed to like a movie like this, and a lot there for people who aren't.
It's funny you bring up Election, because I think Election's another movie that doesn't fit in a box, right? Part of the reason that that film didn't perhaps connect, although critics were obviously far more in love with Election than this film. But again, like we're seeing that the movies that tend to stand the test of time, at least I feel this way in a lot of ways with the movies of 99, are the ones that don't, that are not clearly defined. The ones that feel like they're trying to do a bunch of things. And it's a symptom of why I think this year was so special is that there's a lot of those. There's a lot of those movies that are just like, you know, you're being John Malkovich's, your Elections, your But I'm a Cheerleader's, whatever it is, films that just refuse to conform in some way to a preconceived notion of what you think this movie is going to be. I think that's awesome.
That's a really good point, Phil. That's why I think I was left cold by so many of these teen movies, because even the ones that are quote unquote good, like 10 Things I Hate About You, are still very cookie cutter. And you know, for the most part, if you look at our top 10 or what I would imagine would be like our top 25 at the end of this, they are all going to be these like feathered fish. Yep. With the exception of Notting Hill. So.
But it was such a transitional year was such a murky, strange year that it makes sense that, I mean, that was in the zeitgeist. So it makes sense that showed up in cinema. And it makes sense that those are the films that have withstood the test of time.
Yeah,
for sure.
And that we keep
sure.
returning to with so much enthusiasm.
I think it's also, you know, a lot of it has to do with the filmmakers that broke through or the films that they made in this particular year. You know, it is a year that has David Fincher, Paul Thomas Anderson, the Wachowskis, Alexander Payne. These are all filmmakers that you know, pride themselves on bucking through any sort of convention. And I think that's – and Spike Jones. Like all of these people that are just trying to find – new, exciting, interesting lanes, and this film absolutely 1000% falls into that category. So, mm-hmm.
And you know, it should also be said that Jamie Babbitt falls into the category of female filmmakers who made a brilliant film, and she is like an extremely busy director, but she directs almost TV.
So much TV.
She directs almost entirely TV, and she's probably one of the most in demand TV directors, particularly for like prestige-y comedic stuff.
Yep.
But she never really got her, you know, give her $50 million and she would see what she could do type movie, which we've seen over and over and over again here. with movies made by female directors that we loved. So,
I mean, it happened with Kimberly Pierce. You know,
Kimberly
it happened
Pierce.
With, you know, it's one, it's you know, with all the positive stuff that's come out of this year, and there's a lot of positive stuff, and obviously we love to highlight those things, we can also see the flip side of it, which is that there's a lot of negatives that came out of this year. And when you look at the amazing films that were made by a slew of filmmakers that did not get another shot coming out of 99 is also a whole other thing.
And so many of them were marginalized people. It's just this situation and the black male directors who made great films as well. And I don't think we've done a single movie by a black female director. So I don't even know if there was one.
So that's, yeah. Well, Lola, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having
me. For this film. I hope that you'll come back. You'll come back for something else, right? I'll send you the list and you'll come back for something else.
Okay.
Sure. What are we doing next week, Phil?
Next week we're doing Flawless. Have you seen Flawless, Lola?
I haven't. What is that?
It is a movie that I don't think Kenny or I would recommend you watch, but it's a movie by Joel Schumacher, his second of 99.
Okay.
Robert De Niro and Phil Seymour Hoffman.
Phils can call each other Phils.
Phils can call each other Phils. Philip Seymour Hoffman. Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a trans character. And De Niro plays a bigoted cop who has a stroke. Philip Seymour Hoffman has to teach him how to sing to work his way through his brain rehabilitation.
That's not even the worst part.
Oh boy!
I wish you all could see the look of sheer horror as Lola covers her face and is just like, "Yeah." So that's next week. Listen.
The irony of the title is just too much.
The movie is rife with irony.
I am so hesitant about making any kind of declaration of quality with my titles because I never want it used against me the way you're using
Flawless.
The Flawless is full of flaws. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's awful. We're having Matthew D'Ambrosio is coming back on. He came on for Teaching Mrs. Tingle back whenever we did that one. And I'm excited to have him on to talk about it. It's going to be a very interesting conversation. If nothing else, Kenny, I look forward to us being able to unpack this movie, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Have you seen Disclosure yet on Netflix?
I have not, but I want to watch it.
I recommend watching it, especially if you're going to do something about trans identity.
I might watch it literally right now.
I might watch it too. Yeah.
It's brilliant.
We absolutely want to make sure that we touch on all this movie. That one of the flaws of Flawless is that it is really all over the map. So it's too packed with ideas, I think, for its own good. I'm hoping that we can unpack all the things that are not working in this movie. but thank you again for coming on, Lola.
Thanks for having me.
We very much appreciate it, and we can't wait to have you back.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.